Welcome to this podcast from Farrer & Co. My name is Sam Talbot-Rice. I'm an associate in Farrer's intellectual property and commercial team. I'm delighted to be hosting this podcast on educational technology, or EdTech, to use the more familiar phrase. And I'm really pleased to welcome Nathan Martin to the podcast. Nathan is a digital strategist and consultant in the field of education policy and technology. And I think is particularly well placed to help us navigate this brave new world of ed tech. Nathan, just to introduce you, you're head of marketing at an ed tech startup called Off to Class. You previously worked at Pearson, amongst other things. Can you tell us a bit about what you do, how you got into the sector and your particular areas of focus now?
Sure, I'm happy to, and it's lovely to join the podcast. I am full-time at Off to Class. Off to Class is a startup that serves English language teachers, so teachers that are working with students whose English might not be their first language. It's a bootstrapped company, based out of Canada, that has grown from being very small over the last 7 years to working in over 100 countries at 100 US school districts. And we make it really, really easy for a teacher who may not be familiar or sort of prepared to spend less time in lesson preparation and more time actually teaching their students. And we've sort of seen huge growth over the last few years during the pandemic. And we're right in the middle of raising our first round this year. So I actually joined with them in January. Before that, I was at Pearson. That was probably the last kind of big thing that I did before I did a bit of consulting. I worked in the strategy team there, the executive team, directing thought leadership and working on some of our efficacy work. Got to do some work with World Economic Forum, and going even further back than that, I worked in the U.S. And kind of cut my teeth working alongside both policy leaders and also in the ed tech with assessments and things in the U.S. So I feel like when I started in ed tech, it was right when the first ed tech bubble was bursting. So this is the time when Rupert Murdoch acquired Wireless Generation for $200 million, and there's all this money coming in. So I came in right at the height of that, watched the bubble pop, watched there be a consolidation, and now we're in the middle of things going back up and there being a huge influx of funding and capital coming in. So I feel like I've been around the block a few times. And what I do now these days is really think about how we tell the story of our product for teachers, how we amplify the voice of the teachers or the districts that are using it. And also how we elevate a company that is very small, but doing important work and help them compete with the Pearsons, with the Nearpods, with the sort of the bigger giants of the world. And so that's where I spend my days doing.
Great stuff. Well, thank you very much for joining. And we can lift the lid a little bit and explore some of these themes a bit further. Obviously, EdTech, it's a huge area, very large and growing, not least following COVID and the various lockdowns across the world, really. I'm conscious it can mean a lot of different things to different people. It's quite an amorphous phrase as to what technology we're talking about in what context and what the implications are for it, for schools, for colleges, for businesses as well. One thing I was interested, just to root our discussion, a book you recommended to me by Justin Reich, Failure to Disrupt, which provides, I think, a really sort of well-balanced view on some of these questions. He identifies kind of three groups of people, of educationalists, when it comes to assessing ed tech, which is, as he puts it, charismatic. So the people who are kind of really, really evangelists for what technology can do in education, skeptics, so I guess are exactly that, those small C conservatives who are much more skeptical about its value. And then somewhere in between, I guess, the tinkerers who believe, like he does, that most of the gains are quite incremental with technology and it doesn't in one go radically transform things. It's all about marginal or incremental gains and some things work, some things don't. Do you like that analysis? And if so, are you in one of those camps?
Yeah, I feel like it's a really useful sort of framing. And I feel like it also sort of mirrors my own journey because I've had the chance to, like, I remember sitting and listening to Sal Khan, who was sort of one of the early, you know, people that really captured people's imagination with this idea of his free courses online that people could do self-taught. Still, you know, an amazing speaker, really transformative, really exciting. And I remember being in a room, you know, listening to him talk and just thinking, my goodness, that's amazing. We can put all these resources here. Not to Garwell talked about, you know, edX. And I remember being excited about that, thinking about like sort of these differentiated instructional models, kind of what maybe AI could do to help personalize assessment, make sure that, you know, what students are studying is really exactly what they needed. You know, how do we bring sort of democratized education? I've been on the other side where I've worked with people like Sir Michael Barber, who is very much focused on sort of big transformational, you know, governmental reforms within the literacy program in the UK or working in Pakistan or other areas. And he tried to do that at Pearson, one of the biggest companies in the world, embedding something like efficacy that, you know, we're going to think about how we embed research at the heart of EdTech. And I worked with the World Economic Forum. We tried to build a platform for education entrepreneurs and innovators to sort of make it easier for them to see where funding was going. And, you know, you could hear the sort of the but coming in my voice. And so I've done all those things. I think that's really important. But I think I'm probably, I'm not a pure skeptic, but I definitely have seen sort of too many startups, too many sort of white papers, too many sort of big pronouncements to think that EdTech or, you know, education is going to transform kind of every aspect of our life. I think people underestimate, and Reich does a really good job of describing this, how complicated education is. Education is not, you know, something like you have like an app on your phone where you can just log in and, you know, you get what you want and it transforms a sector like that. You know, ironically, everyone used to say, well, you know, we need an Uber for education. And now Uber is seeing just how difficult transforming something like transportation is. Same thing for Netflix, actually. Netflix is, you know, lost, you know, users this week. And so even that area is sort of facing some challenges. Education touches not just learning, it touches health, it touches, you know, social structure, it touches all those things. And so for any sort of piece of technology to fundamentally impact that, it has to address all aspects of that. And so, you know, I think those three categories are really good, but where I'd put myself is probably in the Reich camp, where I think that the biggest area that we can think of, and I, you know, for anyone that's listening, where you can spend your time really well is less time thinking about, you know, VR and AR and rolling out some new piece of kit, and more about thinking about where can we make marginal improvements that help improve teacher efficiency, that are based in, you know, rooted in solid pedagogy, they're rooted in what we know works in learning, and really trying to make smart investments in those areas, and then sticking with things. You know, I think that's one of the things that, you know this from your own experience, whether it's a government policymaker or a business executive, people turn over far too quickly. And so it takes time for good policy to sort of sink in, to get rooted in. And so when it comes to these sort of three categories, I would definitely put myself on sort of the tinkerer category. It might not be the sexiest thing in the world. In fact, like, it's part of the reason I took the job that I've taken now, is that the platform and the product that we offer, it's not the sexiest thing in the world. It's not the thing that's going to grab everyone's attention, but it solves a problem for teachers, and they really love it. It helps make their lives better, and it's improving learning outcomes for students. And for me, that seems really interesting as I look at the larger landscape. So I think, you know, those three categories are very accurate. I don't think it also, by the way, helps anyone to go too hard into the charismatic or skeptic, because technology is part of our lives. We need it. You know, as much as it may have problems during the pandemic, it did also allow people to continue learning, even if it was interrupted, even if it wasn't as high quality. But we also need to also not make over promises. The whole, you know, rush to the metaverse, rush to whatever it might be, that also doesn't serve learners very well as well. So firmly in the tinkering category.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. I think, I mean, as you say, some things are just part of the furniture now, aren't they? With whether it's just course delivery online, you know, providing different ways to get educational content, which may still be a traditional teacher-led, instruction-led, but delivered, you know, over the internet through so-called, you know, MOOCs in some cases, these online, you know, large-scale online courses, or again, as sort of has become second nature, using devices in and out of the classroom to give children, you know, a wider range of access to content, to apps, to learning, you know, whether it's times tables, languages, just a different range of content and delivery. And then, as you say, you've got the, I guess, the more speculative kind of cool sounding stuff, whether it's AR or AI, as you say, augmented reality, artificial intelligence, all a bit more speculative, but, you know, possibly some exciting stuff there around possible personalization, but perhaps a lot more uncertain as to how it's actually and the efficacy of it in terms of day-to-day embedding it within delivery in schools and colleges.
And you also have to think about, Sam, like, one of the important things is, you know, who is this going to serve? And so if you're a policymaker, things, you know, each bit of this kit or technology, yeah, it might help some learners. And I think Wright gets into this as well, like MOOCs are really useful, or these massive open online courses are really useful in helping some motivated learners. But when we think about a policy that is going to work for an entire school, you know, you really have to be careful and think about, like, does it make sense to invest in this kit that maybe benefits 10 students who are able to use it well? Or would we be better off rolling out, you know, something that would raise the floor and support everyone to a higher level? And that's where I think some of the trade-offs and things have to happen.
That's really, really interesting. And in terms of, you've touched on obviously the impact of COVID, which has been significant. Do we know much now, as you've alluded to, a lot of the technology has actually been around for quite a while now. We've had sort of boom and bust in a sense. How much do we know about actually what works and what doesn't work when technology is used in educational settings? And are there some things that we just know are more effective than others?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, it's kind of boring, but, you know, when it comes to what works, you know, there's a sort of a smell test that you can go to when it comes to ed tech, and there's certain safer bets that you know, we know that anything that allows a teacher to spend more time with a student is going to be something, you know, so anything that frees up sort of personalized instruction. So you see the huge investment into tutoring programs, anything that would allow sort of personalized tutors more time, you know, doing that, whether it's virtually or in person, that's always a good thing. I think anything sort of diagnostic assessments, you know, we have a diagnostic assessment on our platform that lets the teacher, a lot of learners, especially the U.S., are either refugees or they're moving around. So you need to figure out very quickly where their English levels are. So those sort of things work. You know, we can figure that out quickly. Things like, you know, sort of anything on that side of thing, we can teach math really well with ed tech. That's something that it can do well. Where it doesn't go as well is when you get things like the sort of the soft skills, when it gets to things like grading essays, you know, those are the areas where there are still some real gaps. And you have to ask yourself the question of kind of, are we requiring the learner to do all the learning? Or are we going to have some sort of, you know, blended approach? What works well is when you have regular delivery, that, it, you know, the teacher is sort of assigning things or checking up, you know, it's sort of that blended approach. Blended learning has always been sort of the best way of approaching it. And so it needs that structure. It needs careful implementation. You know, so much of what works is less about the tool itself, and it's about the implementation of the tool. So you need to have something that's rooted in research, you know, that there's sort of just like with wellness or anything else like that, there's lots of bad things that are not actually backed up by learning. But if you start with something that we know about the learning sciences, we know about sort of brain, you know, how humans assimilate knowledge, spaced repetition, you know, sort of desirable difficulty. Once you get past that point, it's so much of it is about implementation, and it's about giving students the space to sort of absorb it, making sure the teachers have support. I don't know if that really answers a question.
I think that does. It's really helpful. And I guess thinking through with lockdowns, you know, it was a mixed blessing in a way, wasn't it? Because the technology was the thing that enabled students to keep learning and teachers to keep delivering. And yet there was obviously a lot of emphasis on sort of social inequality, pupils not having access to devices or good quality Wi-Fi at home, or even a space to work. And it's still requiring a lot of time and effort for parents, for example.
Yeah, you can't just stick a, you know, I know you have kids and they'll get to that age where it's like you can't just stick them in front of a computer and expect that learning to happen. I think you got to an important point about inequality, and you know, it's slightly different here, but I was talking to a teacher from Georgia yesterday, and she was talking about how she had coped with the pandemic, and because of the area that she's in, there is a lot of inequality, and that her students did not have Wi-Fi at home. A lot of them didn't have access. So she would take her little Wi-Fi hotspot, go to their trailer park, sit in the middle of there so they can come and you know, get that. And it's sort of extraordinary to think about in 2021 or 2022 that's still the case in the US or the UK or wherever it is. But I think it's too easy for us to assume that everyone has the same level, that it's a level playing field, that everyone has that support, or that even, you know, for students, that they have a safe environment. Like part of what's so important about schools is that they go in and that for a lot of them, you know, they have a good support structure. They have a teacher that cares for them, that's trying to, like, you know, give them that backing. And not every kid has that at home. You know, hopefully some students have parents that love them, but not everyone has a safe and sort of supportive home environment. And that is really critical for learning. It's really hard for you to go assimilate new knowledge if you don't feel safe. And so, you know, I think, you know, COVID sort of amplified that, but it also sort of showed that technology by itself is not going to be the answer. And I'm sure it also, just like with the NHS, reminded people about how much our teachers do that we sort of forget and maybe don't always take, we don't always kind of give them the appreciation that they deserve.
Yeah, I think a lot of parents realize that this is not the job that anyone can just pick up and just do. I certainly had a lot of that from friends. And in terms of, you mentioned the sort of incremental gains and how ed tech can actually, if it's used well, free teachers up to do what they do best, i.e. teach students. It struck me that actually some of the less glamorous side of it might actually be the most useful, as you've hinted, which is, you know, possibly not so much delivery of content, but possibly freeing teachers up from some of the admin of teaching, whether it's assessment, recruitment, timetabling. To the extent to which processes can be automated, it may actually be some of those jobs that in a sense is less about the front line of delivery, but it's actually enabling teachers to spend more time doing the traditional thing of teaching and less time on the administrative.
Yeah, and it was one of the things I just read a report about kind of English language learners, because that's obviously the area I focus on during the US. And it was just talking about for so many schools, how challenging it was for these teachers who were juggling a million different things to just have time for lesson planning. I mean, you know, I think it's something, it's such a small thing, but when it comes time to pull a lesson together, teachers are always working behind too often. So that's what, you know, one of the things that we focus, we make it super easy for teachers to get a lesson pulled together. And, you know, I think anything that frees them up, I think that's kind of another interesting point though, that I've been thinking about. It's about kind of what data teachers need. And in the early sort of stage of ed tech, or sort of the bubble stage, it was like, we're gonna give teachers all this information about student learning. We're gonna show them everything about that. And actually, like, teachers, just like anyone else, they don't have time to look at, you know, so we need to think about what are sort of the data metrics and what are the sort of the points that we actually need, and how do we sort of give them just the information that they need so that they can kind of spend more time with their students.
And in terms of some of the challenges, we've touched a bit on that from an educational perspective, but obviously the more stuff that we do online, the more issues will come up in terms of privacy, data protection. Speaking as a data protection lawyer, obviously, data security is obviously increasing area of focus. I mean, I think from my perspective, schools are obviously much more aware of these issues. Data protection compliance is obviously a hugely important area. There's increasingly a focus on what happens to children's data where it's collected and processed. Indeed, the regulator, the ICO, have got specific standards for online service providers when they're holding children's data. There are rules around marketing to children. Are we seeing from your and indeed on the data security front, obviously, concerns around vulnerability of systems, both in terms of the schools themselves or colleges, and indeed these providers that are holding large amounts of data? Are we seeing some trends here that we need to be aware of in terms of compliance and sort of gold standards of how providers of technology services are seeking to perhaps allay concerns on this front?
Yeah, I would encourage anyone that's whether you're the ed tech provider side or the school side to you know, you do need to get proper expertise, proper experts, which is exactly what I know you and your team focus on, because the reality is on a broader level, schools are being targeted, right? Like there's sort of the regulatory questions that you've raised of, you know, making sure that you're being compliant, making sure that you're not vulnerable or sort of liable to sort of a fine or falling out of compliance. But the reality is as well is that schools have become targeted of hackers, of sort of ransomware, and it's incredibly depressing because these hackers and the people that are trying to extort money. You know, I've seen messages from schools where these people are, you know, asking for money, and they're like, "Well, we're a school," and the hackers are like, I don't care, right? Like this is, it's just purely transactional. It's purely that they're going to be going after this. And the reason this happens is because schools, as you might expect, you know, it's part of the shift with technology. When school started, and everything's in a book, or it's in a notebook, or whatever it might be, you know, that unless someone literally walks into the schoolhouse and takes that out, You know, you're not going to have an issue with that. And sort of the evolution has come in the classrooms. Now we have things, you know, digital courseware, the rest of that, student records are collected online. But there's not been a sort of shift in terms of operating practice where there's sort of the gold standard of where everything is sort of evolved at the same time. So it's been a very piecemeal approach. And even the people that work in schools, you know, the people that you hire to work in schools, the administrators, they've done the best that they could, but a lot of times they're working with the outdated systems, they're juggling different things. So, you know, you've had times where spreadsheets of students' data has been accidentally left where you know, it can be seen publicly. And people are working to get to that point, but it's something that just can't be sort of left to chance going forward.
Yeah, and I think also seeing increasing kind of, I guess, awareness that I guess particularly third-party platforms and providers don't want or need to be holding large amounts of identifiable information, particularly of students. And so as far as possible, seeking to anonymize that such that it is still useful for sort of performance monitoring and for improving the services, but actually it's not linked to specific students.
Yeah, and that's a trend that I think, I don't have an answer to it and I don't know where it's gonna end up. But one of the things that's really interesting is watching the rise, you know, as you might imagine, when you're doing things digitally, people have to have solutions to prevent things like cheating. So digital proctoring, digital sort of monitoring of those things. You know, there's a lot of very valid concerns and critiques for both students, but also privacy advocates about how invasive that some of these technological solutions are. You know, yes, you want to keep a student from cheating, but you make it incredibly hard for them to actually do the work. You collect tons of data on them while you're doing it to try to prevent cheating. And it, you know, it really does make the educational experience very poor. But also, I think there will be, you know, some pushback, rightfully so, on a legal level. And I don't know how much in the UK, but in the US, that's definitely happening. And so, you know, we sort of have to think about the longer term and not just sort of a blunt tool to solve the problem right now, but think about digitally how you can sort of prepare for that going forward.
Definitely agree with that. And looking kind of taking a step back, now we've sort of hopefully come out of COVID and looking at the trends you talked about, you know, huge explosion of interest and activity in it. Looking globally, are there some big themes that you can pick out in terms of the business of edtech, the marketplace and what's been going on there?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, the money is just, like, the last 2 years, you know, you've seen just an explosion of investment into edtech companies. You had, you know, $8.2 billion invested in U.S. companies in 2021. In Europe, you had $2.5 billion invested. You have a number of new edtech unicorns, so companies that are valued over $1 billion. More than a third of those were minted in 2021. And so you know, the money is there. The appetite from investors has never been sort of higher, although there's maybe a little question about whether it's kind of like slowing slightly right now. But the trends are, interestingly, one of the trends was a move away from China, because China banned for-profit ed tech providers. And so that immediately wiped out a number of companies that had quite high hopes. You know, companies that provided tutoring was a big thing. A lot of tutors were left stranded. Some of them ended up working with us as a result. So China's kind of off the table in terms of thinking about kind of where, you know, at least for now, where we're going to look for edtech business. India is still a huge one. You know, any sort of market where credentialing or sort of the acquisition of certain skills carries a premium. So in England, you know, in India, if you can speak English, you can raise your earning potential by 500%. So that's, you know, a very clear area that, you know, that there's opportunity. I think other areas of investment that we see in trends are, so tutoring will continue to get kind of investment. There'll be a consolidation on that front. Social emotional learning, so anything that's sort of trying to help develop those sort of life skills. I've seen a lot of investments in students' mental health. Like, people recognize that after COVID that there's a lot of students that are struggling, that are having a difficult time. That will continue to have investment. Anything that links jobs and employment. So in the U.S., you've had a huge rise of employers funding job certifications. So people can get trained, get a degree while they work. It doesn't cost them anything. In the U.K., you've seen, you know, some similar things. You've got Multiverse is a really important company that in the U.K. that's sort of really bringing those apprenticeships and linking them up with jobs and employers. I think that's a good bet. Anything around kind of corporate learning. we'll continue to see a growth and sort of a building there. So, and the other trend that I think that you have to watch for is that there's a lot of these companies that have raised a number of rounds and have still not figured out the profitability point. And so, you know, it's one of the things I found interesting about the company that I'm working for. They've not taken any money and they are profitable. I think it's kind of actually a rare thing right now. And so I think you will see a consolidation. You've seen some big Houghton Mifflin, I believe it was Houghton Mifflin, just went private. So you've seen some big publishers that have been taken private by private equity. Pearson, who I used to work for, has had some aggressive private equity companies offer to take them private. So you might have some consolidation on that front as well. So yeah, those are some of the trends we're seeing.
Really interesting. It sounds like it's a huge amount going on. It may even be worth us coming back in a few months. And there's a lot of interesting issues and questions. I'm conscious we've tried to cover a lot, but it has meant that that there's lots more still to discuss. But I think, as I say, it'd be great to come back and pursue some of these a little bit further in a bit more detail. I think we've probably run out of time for now. But Nathan, thank you very much indeed for your time. Thank you to everyone for listening, and watch this space as we hope to do more in this area going forward. Thank you.